6 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Steve Norman reporting. A top British government investigator says in a report released Thursday that Russian President Vladimir Putin probably personally approved the assassination of Alexander Litvinenko. Litvinenko was a Russian spy turned dissident who was exiled in Britain after criticizing Putin. Here's British Prime Minister David Cameron.
We must now read the report in its entirety and take everything into account. But be in no doubt, this shocking event was reacted to years ago when it happened, and we're toughening our action again today.
In Moscow, a Russian foreign ministry spokesperson said, and I quote, "We regret that a purely criminal case has been politicized and has darkened the general atmosphere of bilateral relations." Military group Al-Shabaab has claimed responsibility for an attack on a restaurant in the Somali capital that a witness says killed at least two people, injured four others. Reports are that more than 20 other people are trapped inside that restaurant. A bomb blast killed at least six people in a Cairo tourist neighborhood Thursday when police raided a suspected militant hideout. Three policemen and at least one civilian are among the dead. Security officials suspect that Muslim Brotherhood militants planted the bomb that exploded when police burst into an apartment. Efforts to launch a political transition in Syria, the plight of Americans missing in Iraq, and the fight against the Islamic State militants are among the issues that Secretary of State John Kerry discussed Thursday in a series of meetings and interviews in Switzerland. You can get more on this story and the rest of the hour's news at our website, voanews.com. This is VOA News. U.S. Vice President Joe Biden is to visit Turkey amid the ongoing fight against the Islamic State militant group and before next week's peace talks in Vienna on Syria. Dorian Jones has details.
Vice President Biden is expected to press Turkey to do more to prevent jihadist infiltration through its border with Syria. The visit comes as Ankara is demanding Washington rein in recent gains by the Syrian Kurdish militia, the PYG, against the Islamic State. Turkey accuses the Syrian Kurdish militia of being linked to PKK rebels, which Turkish forces are fighting. Biden is scheduled to meet with representatives of Turkey's civic society. Turkey's U.S. ambassador, John Bass, last week strongly condemned the prosecution of academics calling for a resumption of a peace process with the PKK. Ongoing tension between Ankara and Baghdad over Turkey's unauthorized deployment of military forces to Bashika in Iraq is also expected to be brought up by Biden. Dorian Jones of VOA News, Istanbul.
U.S. Defense Chief Ash Carter says the 200 American commandos now in Iraq and Syria are carrying out raids on Islamic State targets, killing or capturing them wherever we find them. Carter said U.S.-led coalition forces have big arrows pointed at reclaiming Mosul in Iraq and Raqqa in northern Syria, the self-proclaimed capital, the religious caliphate the Islamic State has declared.
After ISIL is defeated, these forces must secure and govern the territory by building long-term trust within the populations that they liberate.
U.S. Defense Chief told a training school for French officers in Paris that the American commandos have already established contact with new forces that share our goals. 1 month after Singapore deported 26 Bangladeshi Muslim migrant workers who have been charged for allegedly supporting the ideology of Islamist terrorists like Al-Qaeda and Islamist State, authorities have said the men were contemplating to participate in and wage armed jihad in the Middle East as well as in Bangladesh. Following a primary investigation, including interrogation of the deportees, Bangladesh police say the men were members of Ansarullah Bangla Team, a banned Bangladeshi hardline Islamist militant outfit that was charged for a series of killings of atheist bloggers in the country last year. And British Prime Minister David Cameron says he is optimistic of securing a deal by February 17th to reform the European Union, which would secure Britain's future and the 28-nation bloc. Get more news at voanews.com.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barton in Washington. Today is Friday, January 22nd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Sierra Leone confirms a second Ebola case since West Africa was declared free of the virus a week ago.
We have transferred her already to the capital city as a military hospital where she's now responding to treatment.
Abdoulaye Birete is Sierra Leone's government spokesman. A Zambian ruling party member resigns, citing intolerance in the party. A U.S.-based justice group calls for the release of political activists in Equatorial Guinea. And Ivory Coast President Alassane Ouattara has met with the leader of former President Gbagbo's party.
It was only meant to be an hour-long meeting, but Ivorian President Alassane Ouattara and the delegation of the Ivorian Popular Front, the FPI, ended up talking for more than 3 hours.
Let's view Emily Yelp in Abidjan. The suicide of a young unemployed Tunisian man sparks protests across the country. And in Zimbabwe, residents of a village where President Robert Mugabe plans to hold his birthday celebration next month say they could use the money to provide decent meals for their families. Those stories plus Marco Uman Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Sierra Leone has confirmed a new case of Ebola, the second since the World Health Organization declared West Africa free of the virus a week ago. The 38-year-old woman is said to be the relative of a 22-year-old woman who died of Ebola January 12. Abdoulaye Birete is the National Publicity and Outreach Coordinator in the office of Sierra Leone's government spokesman. He says the woman has been transferred to a military hospital in the capital Freetown, where she is responding to treatment.
We recorded a case of a 22-year-old student in a town called Lusail in northern Sierra Leone who traveled to a place called Bamoi Lumo in the Cambia district, a district that bordered with neighboring Guinea. And she ended up in a place called Maguraka. And in the process, she died. And of course, we had to quarantine about 109 people. And of these 109, we had 28 high risks. And of this number, a second case is just been reported again of a 38-year-old aunt who was nursing this very student. So that is where we are. We have transferred her already to the capital city as a military hospital where she is now responding to treatment.
You say you have transferred the person to the military hospital in Freetown. What happens to the area where this person comes from? Are there any centers? And if you do this, are you not spreading the disease?
Yes. Well, the disease is not going to spread because, as I mentioned, we still have all the structures in place, including the surveillance and contact tracers, as well as our ambulance teams. That was why no sooner the fourth case index was recorded, we had to activate the situation room immediately. And as I'm speaking to you, the reason why we had to transport to the military hospital in Freetown was because we don't want to waste any single time to get all the people on board at either Makeni, which is the provincial headquarter town for the north, where we had one of the very successful treatment centers. The one at the military hospital is already up and running. We said, well, to save time, let us bring her immediately to that hospital.
The understanding is that this woman was taking care of somebody who died, and this woman might have washed the body. Is that true?
That is quite true, because what happened, a situation which the chief medical officer had already explained, was that this particular initial case index didn't meet the case definition for Ebola. She didn't present with any hemorrhagic fever. There was no reddish. So all she presented was vomiting, and she was treated for malaria and things like that. So that has even warranted a review of the IPC, which is the Infection and Prevention Control Systems in all the hospitals, that any patient that should come there, we shouldn't take any chances, particularly when the president has already launched the lessons learned from the Ebola. So we don't want to have a recurrence. It is just that in this case, according to the CMO, this particular lady of the fourth case index didn't show any signs of Ebola as defined in the case studies.
Abdullahi Birite is the National Publicity and Outreach Coordinator in the Office of Sierra Leone's Government Spokesman. He was speaking with me from the capital, Freetown. Ivory Coast President Alassane Ouattara yesterday met with opposition leader Pascal Affi N'Guessa in Abidjan. Nguessan is the president of the Ivorian Popular Front, the party of former President Laurent Gbagbo. The two men were expected to discuss various sensitive subjects, including national reconciliation and the release of political prisoners. Emily Yop reports from Abidjan.
It was only meant to be an hour-long meeting, but Ivorian President Alassane Ouattara and the delegation of the Ivorian Popular Front, the FPI, ended up talking for more than 3 hours. Speaking to the press just after the meeting, Pascal Affi N'Guessa said he was satisfied with his first meeting. We have seen real progress, he said, and the political will to settle all problems related to the post-electoral crisis, N'Guessa said. In 2010 and 2011, the results of the presidential elections were disputed and supporters of Ouattara clashed with those of the FPI, then led by incumbent President Laurent Gbagbo. At least 3,000 people died in 5 months of violence, which ended when Gbagbo was arrested and put in jail. He is currently awaiting trial at the International Criminal Court. Thursday's meeting was requested by the FBI mainly to discuss the release of the remaining political prisoners of that post-electoral crisis. On that too, Affi N'Guessa said progress was made. Regarding the political prisoners, he said, the principle of the release was agreed on. FPI spokesperson Agnès Monet said these issues are key for sustainable peace in Ivory Coast. When it comes to national reconciliation, it has always been linked to the problems of the post-electoral crisis, she said. Other subjects discussed included the return of the remaining refugees and the unfreezing of the assets of some of FPI's executives. But not all of the FPI was at this meeting. Since last year, the party has been experiencing a deep internal crisis, which led a section of Gbagbo's supporters to break away from the party and boycott the elections. To them, no talk is possible prior to the release of Laurent Gbagbo, whereas the section of the FPI, led by Affi N'Guessa, has been willing to come back into the political game. Monet says a new meeting with the government may happen in the next few weeks to continue the talks. Emily Yap for VOA News in Abidjan.
A founding member of Zambia's ruling Patriotic Front Party has resigned from the party, citing intolerance, hate, vengeance, and violence that he said has been meted out to supporters. Until his resignation on Thursday, Mili Sampa was Deputy Commerce Minister and a leading member of the Central Committee of the ruling party. Frank Bualia, Deputy Spokesman for the Patriotic Front Party, tells reporter Peter Clotty that the party is not surprised about Sampa's decision to resign ahead of the August 11 presidential election, adding that the resignation is unlikely to hinder the party's prospects of winning the poll.
To hear that our brother has resigned may be something not surprising to us. However, I must hasten to say that we have not received any official communication from him to that effect. What we have heard is that he has posted something on his Facebook page or account. I have not had the time to check out whatever he may have posted there. So we will respond when and if he is going to inform us officially that he has left the club called PF. Because when you join a club, you declare your intention to join and you are registered. So if he has resigned, he's going to let us know. He rose to the level in the party of being a member of the Central Committee. He was appointed as a deputy minister. And I want to believe that having risen to such a level, he should be able to follow basic procedure.
He made reference to the party's intolerance, hate and vengeance and violent conduct towards party members that supported him as a basis to leave the party, akin, he says, to the MMD of 2011 that used violence to intimidate and harass opponents ahead of the election. This is a very, very senior member of this party raising such allegations against your party, the ruling Patriotic Front Party. It doesn't bode well for you, does it?
I must say that politicians can come up with the best reasons under the sun for certain actions, even those actions that are not well-intentioned. So the fact that a man may come up with such reasons does not in any way point to any accurate analysis on his part of the situation obtaining in Zambia. Somebody can resign from their job because they know they'll be fired tomorrow because they stole some money, and they would still come up with the best reason ever given for somebody resigning from such a position.
Hearing such things, and as a prominent member of the party as well, does this concern you, or particularly when August is just around the corner for general election?
It doesn't concern me because it is not talking about what is obtaining on the ground. If a doctor tells me I've got HIV and AIDS, it would concern me if the test has come out as such. But if the test is negative, I will not be concerned. As a matter of fact, I would be concerned that this doctor must be insane.
One of the accusations being leveled against the president is that he's not a unifier.
Does that mean that this issue of the president failing to unite the party has only happened in the last 2 or 3 weeks? Because this is about 3 or 2 weeks when he said he was going to support the leadership of President Edgar Sagwalungu because he believed in this leadership and that the president was doing everything possible to move the country forward and to provide leadership in the party.
Frank Bualia is the deputy spokesman for Zambia's ruling Patriotic Front Party. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from the capital, Lusaka. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, January 22nd, and please send your comments and viewpoints to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Let's send out a shout-out to listeners on our affiliate station, Capital FM, in Blantyre, Malawi. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 17 minutes past the hour. The U.S.-based EG Justice is calling for the immediate release of two political activists arrested earlier this week in Equatorial Guinea. The men were arrested for driving around in their car, handing out leaflets and using a megaphone to announce that they will be discussing issues such as the economy at an upcoming political meeting. Although they had permits for the meeting, authorities maintained the men were potentially causing a public disturbance. Tutu Alexander, the head of EG Justice, tells Ricky Stryer, this is just one of many ways that President Teodoro Obiang Nguema Mbasogo is clamping down on opposition before the country's upcoming elections. Mr. Mbasogo has led the country since 1979 and will be running again in this year's elections.
This is the ironic part of everything, right? That, you know, the party, the CPDS, had an authorization signed by the proper authorities, the Minister of Interior, to hold a meeting. And these two young men had a megaphone and were just driving around town announcing the fact that there was going to be a meeting the next day. And according to the police, they arrested them. The one thing that they did wrong was discussing or talking about the issues that were going to be discussed at the meeting, that supposedly they didn't have a permission to talk about those issues. I mean, this is complete absurdity.
They had permits to have the meeting and to talk about the issues at the meeting, but not to talk about the issues before the meeting, is what the authorities are saying.
Yes, that's what the government claims. But clearly that's infringement of freedom of expression. To say that, yes, you can announce that you're having a meeting, but you cannot say that you're going to be discussing the state of the economy in the country, that you're going to be discussing corruption in Equatorial Guinea. Imagine any other country that you cannot say publicly that, oh, we are going to have a meeting to discuss corruption in the country. How absurd is that, and what type of blatant infringement of freedom of expression that constitutes?
The timing of the meeting is because there are elections coming up in Equatorial Guinea. Is that correct?
That is correct. The government has, in fact, launched a census phase. Right now, they are conducting census, and this is to presumably register any eligible voters. And what that signals is that the election period, you know, is very close. And what sources tell me, you know, is that most likely at the end of this census period, which is going to end in a couple of weeks at the end of January, the elections will be announced at the end of January. That would give the government and the opposition parties the whole month of February to campaign, and presumably elections could be held as early as March 2016, this year.
And these are presidential elections.
Indeed, these are presidential elections, which we now have the wonderful situation again that, you know, instead of elections, what we're having is is a presidential selection. President Obiang has announced that he will be running as the candidate for the ruling party, the Democratic Party of Equatorial Guinea, PDGE. And what that means, if we know the history of Equatorial Guinea and President Obiang, is that he will again win with between 95 and 99% of the vote.
That was Tutu Alicant, the head of the U.S.-based EG Justice. He was speaking to Ricky Stryer from Tampa, Florida, here in the United States. Protests have been spreading across parts of Tunisia during the past week after a young unemployed man committed suicide. The wave of unpopular unrest appears to coincide with the fifth anniversary of the ouster of President Zine Al Abidine Ben Ali. Edward Urania reports for VOA from Cairo.
Clashes among small crowds of young protesters and police continue to rock the eastern Tunisian town of Kasserine, along with half a dozen other towns and cities. Protests broke out Saturday after 27-year-old Rida Yahyaoui electrocuted himself after failing to land a public sector job. Unemployed workers and young people have demonstrated in front of several government buildings in the capital, Tunis, as well, to draw attention to their plight. Tunisian state TV quoted an interior ministry spokesman as saying agitators were infiltrating popular protests to provoke violence. He urged protesters to beware of terrorists or troublemakers in their midst. Several dozen protesters were hurt during clashes Tuesday and Wednesday. Police in several regions are also protesting after the death of an officer during a clash Wednesday. One protester said he and those around him are not seeking violence. He says the demonstrators have legitimate demands and are conducting a peaceful movement, refusing violence and destruction of property. University of Paris political science professor Khattar Abu Diab says social justice is a major problem in Tunisia. He says no matter who runs the country, Tunisia has suffered from the unequal distribution of wealth. He says the capital and wealthy areas along the coast are better treated than interior areas of the country. He adds people have won more freedom since the 2011 revolution, but want more concrete items like food and jobs. Tunisian President Baji Kaïda Sabsi told state TV he understood the plight of the young and unemployed, and the government is planning to hire several thousand people in public service jobs. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Most villagers in the drought-prone Masvingo province of Zimbabwe, where the ruling ZANU-PF party is planning to hold a lavish $800,000 birthday celebration for President Robert Mugabe next month, say they are living from hand to mouth due to the current dry spell. The majority claim they are now surviving on eating wild fruits in the region where about 5,000 cattle have died as a result of the lack of pastures and state-assisted stock feed. As Gandri Maramba of VOA Zimbabwe program reports, the villagers are not happy about the cost of Mr. Mugabe's upcoming birthday celebration.
Meetings are being held behind closed doors where some top ZANU-PF officials are planning to throw a birthday party for President Mugabe, who turns 92 on February 21st. This has drawn the ire of local people, who say ZANU-PF leaders are cold-hearted as they will be holding an event that is said to cost about 800,000. One of the irate local inhabitants is Prosper Tiringindi.
To me, it doesn't make sense because if I look right now, the current situation that we have in Zimbabwe, actually, we are facing a series of drought. Actually, I think the president must do something with that money. They must buy maize from outside of the country and feed the Zimbabweans rather than to enjoy in a day. Yes, of course, we can celebrate flamboyant birthday, but actually the citizens are suffering.
Another local villager, Mugove Makonesi, says the lavish birthday is not a new thing, as the president has been doing this for almost three decades.
Mugabe is well known the world over for being a very insensitive leader. This is the time that they should be mobilizing resources to save the lives of the people of Zimbabwe, and particularly the people of Machungo province, who are perennially hunger and drought ravaged. This insensitivity is nothing surprising.
Villagers say the ruling party, which has been in power for more than 35 years, should dump the Bedide Bash and start looking into the needs of all communities. Pilani Moyo, a Mwenezi district villager who is into cattle farming, says President Mugabe and his party should use the funds raised for the birthday party to buy fodder for millions of livestock.
We had asked for assistance from the government to stock our cattle and to buy cattle feed, but till today there is no response. We are very, very sad that our government is using a lot of money for just one day for a bash, for one person to enjoy.
But ZANU-PF birthday party organizing committee member JP Jabun has strongly defended plans for throwing a lavish birthday party for the president, saying Mr. Mugabe deserves to be honored in such a big way. Last year, Zimbabweans were infuriated when at least 3 million was spent for a lavish 50th birthday party for Mr. Mugabe's wife, Grace. Reporting in Masungu for Studio 7, this is Gandhi Maramba.
Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Mark Owuma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Friday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with football at the Orange Africa Nations Championships in Rwanda. Ethiopia and Cameroon played to a scoreless draw at the Huye Stadium in Butare, some 140 kilometers south of the capital, Kigali, on Thursday. This contrasts with the earlier match at the same venue where fans witnessed six goals as the Democratic Republic of Congo dismissed Angola 4-2 in the other Group B tie. Nelson Muganga, Elia Meshak, Jonathan Bolingi, Merville Bope Bokadi each found the back of the net for the Congolese, while Nelson Sumba replied for Angola before the Congolese captain and defender Joel Kimu Mwaki converted the tournament's first own goal. Consequently, the Democratic Republic of Congo have 6 points and have qualified for the quarterfinals. Cameroon has 4 points. Ethiopia won, while Angola has yet to earn a point. Today, Friday, Tunisia and Nigeria face off before Niger challenge Guinea in Group C action at the Nyamiramba Stadium in Kigali. Tomorrow, Saturday, Zimbabwe play Mali before Uganda engage Zambia in Group D action at the Umganda Stadium in Gishenyi, some 160 kilometers and northwest of the capital, Kigali. On Sunday, Rwanda engage Morocco in Kigali as Ivory Coast play Gabon in Butare in the final round of the Group A preliminaries. Meanwhile, Djibouti challenge Egypt, Ethiopia face Cameroon, and Namibia encounter Nigeria in the Africa qualifiers for the FIFA Women's Under-17 World Cup tomorrow, Saturday. Turning to handball, hosts Egypt beat defending champions Algeria 22-18 on the first day at the Africa Men's Handball Championships in Cairo on Thursday. Morocco dismissed Gabon 29-23 as Cameroon outplayed Nigeria 24-16 in the other Group A fixtures. In Group B, Angola outplayed Kenya 42-16, Tunisia dismissed Libya 30-18, and the Democratic Republic of Congo pipped the Republic of Congo 30-29. Today, Friday, Gabon challenged Algeria, Morocco faced Cameroon, and Nigeria engage Egypt. In other matches, Libya encounter Angola, Kenya challenge the Republic of Congo, the Democratic Republic of Congo face Tunisia. Tomorrow, Saturday, Nigeria play Gabon, Algeria engage Morocco as Egypt face Cameroon. Tunisia tackle Kenya, Angola encounter the Republic of Congo, and the Democratic Republic of Congo face Libya. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Olma in Johannesburg, South Africa, wishing you all a sporty weekend. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good weekend, and we'll see you again on Monday morning. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Two former Burundian presidents have appealed to the UN Security Council to press the current government to accept an African Union-led peacekeeping force. And that's it for this Friday, January 22nd edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Batty, wishing all of you in Africa a very good weekend.
Next on Let's Talk. Traditional music. Are you a big fan? Does it bring good memories to you? Who is your favorite traditional music artist? Join host Sunday Shomari and his guests discussing traditional music. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.